The case of United States versus Rafael Zaragoza, the argument was vacated. Be heard at a later date. We go to the last case of the morning, which is Marisol Cisneros Cornejo versus Keisler.
May I please the court?
Is your name Ms. Alma Alvarado?
Alma Alvarado.
Both names?
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel
proceed.
For the appellant. Your Honor, if I'm late, I apologize. I was waiting in the other courtroom.
What'd you say?
Mm-mm. You're not late. You're on time.
I had been waiting in the other courtroom.
But someone else would have been waiting for you there, too.
You're right on time. So.
Yeah, you made it fine.
Yeah.
Mrs. Nero's arguments before the immigration judge, Board of Immigration Appeals, and before this court have consistently claimed that her failure for not attending her immigration court did not receive notice of the hearing. While it is true that in this court, Mrs. Nero's chose not to argue that she gave the government constructive notice of her correct address and to focus instead on whether her sworn statement and the circumstantial evidence that's outlined on page 13 is sufficient to support her claim of non-receipt of that hearing notice, her arguments before the immigration judge and the BIA all address the adequacy of notice and the reason for her not attending the hearing. Consequently, even though Mrs. Narrows may have forfeited her right to argue the constructive notice issue that was before the BIA, the issue of whether or not she received the hearing notice and whether her motion to reopen was properly denied remains within this court's jurisdiction. Citing this court's precedent decision in Joshi versus Ashcroft, the BIA concluded that Mrs. Narrows did not meet her burden to show non-receipt of the notice, yet failed to address any of the circumstantial evidence presented by Mrs. Narrows.
Now, one of the things that she didn't do was have the uncle provide an affidavit, right? Because couldn't he have done an affidavit saying the letter never came to his home?
Your Honor, your point is very well taken.
And that wasn't...
not considered until much later.
Because that would have certainly put you in a much stronger position, because now you're just left with her affidavit.
Her affidavit, and we hope that this court will consider evidence that she has outlined in her petition.
So you think that other evidence distinguishes it from other cases? Because normally just an affidavit by the petitioner is not enough.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that it distinguishes it. It actually places it in line with the cases that have been decided in this circuit, Joshi being one, Peralta Cabrera being another, Tarasoff being another, and two cases out of the Second Circuit, which were cited in our brief, where the hearing notice was, number one, sent by regular mail, and number two, never returned to the immigration court. In those cases, aside from the fact that there was a sworn affidavit like Mrs. Narrows, the court also paid special attention to the circumstantial evidence being, number one, that the motions to reopen were filed shortly after the respondent received the in absentia order. Number two, that there was no motivation for those respondents to abscond, to fail to appear for their hearings, which in this case there is also. Mrs. Narrows points out that the Immigration Service knew all the time where she was residing. She was paid a special visit at her parents' home, where she resides still today, by one of the ICE officers who was present when she was apprehended.
But he didn't send out the mail, does he?
I'm sorry, Judge.
He didn't send out the mail, did he?
I don't believe that he did. The I-213, all of those documents that are prepared in connection with the notice to appear are signed off by a different person.
Those other cases that you cited, was it supposedly sent to the correct address?
They were supposedly sent to the correct address in one case. In another case, the individual claimed that it was no longer his address. It was an uncle's address or a friend's address, but had the building had been burglarized at some point in time. That was his explanation for the notice not having been received.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, of course, she... Mm-hmm. notified to correct the address and didn't.
Yes, and the other point in the Lopez case, out of the Second Circuit was that in that situation, the respondent was also eligible for some form of relief, which in this case, Mrs. Narrows would have been eligible to apply for voluntary departure. She would have been able to apply for voluntary departure with at least a 120-day period to depart at her master calendar hearing, regardless of whether she had resided in the United States for a year. In this case, Mrs. Narrows contends that the BIA failed to consider any of the corroborative evidence in the record that support her claim of non-deceit. Most importantly, the speediness with which she filed her motion to reopen just 6 days after she received an in absentia notice to appear, and as I have just mentioned, the two other points, the fact that Immigration Service knew where they could find her if she failed to appear, and if they wanted to apprehend her, they could. She also knew that she would have been able to apply for voluntary departure, which is not something, it's a privilege to be able to depart this country when you're in removal proceedings under voluntary departure. Now what Mrs. Narrows faces is a five-year bar, and not until that five-year bar is completed in her home country will she be able to apply for a discretionary waiver of that removal order. She is the unmarried daughter. Her father and mother are both permanent residents. Between now and the time that a visa number may possibly become available to her, maybe within the next 2 years, but if she's facing this five-year bar, she's going to be forced to be out of the country for 5 years. That also was motivation for her not to miss her hearing. Aside from the fact that she was waiting for the hearing notice, Officer Trevino told her she was going to get that notice, but it never came. I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left for the bar.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Elliott.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Elliott, and I represent the Attorney General. The petition for review should be dismissed because petitioner failed to raise her current claims to the Board of Immigration Appeals in the first instance, and therefore she failed to exhaust her administrative remedies. This Court should not properly consider such unexhausted claims. Alternatively, the petition for review should be denied because the Board of Immigration Appeals, as well as the immigration judge, did not abuse their discretion when they reasonably concluded the petitioner had not met her burden of proof and she had not shown that she did not receive the hearing notice. The petitioner was provided two opportunities through counsel to prove the legitimacy of her claims, once before the immigration judge and once before the Board of Immigration Appeals, and she failed to do so.
Well, I'm wondering what you would say is enough to overcome the presumption of In other words, here we had her filing an affidavit saying she hadn't received it. If the uncle had filed an affidavit, do you think that would have been enough?
It would have something that should have been considered, definitely. As this Court has consistently held, a self-serving affidavit is only weak evidence of non-receipt. If she may have provided an affidavit from her uncle, that definitely would have been lent support to her case and should have been considered. It doesn't change the fact that she has not. And she raises a series of factual assertions in her opening brief in support of her claim of non-receipt, but she didn't raise those factual assertions to the board in the first instance. In fact,
so that would be your rationale for why the board doesn't address any of those circumstantial matters in its order?
Well, I believe that she raises it for the first time to this court, and it's been unexhausted. I believe the board did address some of her factual assertions. They explicitly noted the date in which her motion to reopen was filed and the date in which the removal order was filed.
So, but I'm saying these underlying facts that she talked about, where the uncle lived, the fact that the agents came to the house, you're saying that was never raised with the board?
That was not raised to the board. That is correct. The only claim that she raises to the board is the allegation that she could not be charged with receiving the notice to appear or the hearing notice because they were sent to the incorrect address. That argument has been waived in her opening brief to this court. And in fact, now she does concede that the notice to appear, the removal order, and the hearing notice were all sent to the same address, and they were sent to the correct address.
Well, let me ask you this. How are the notices mailed? It's just regular mail, right?
That's right.
Even though there's a signed certificate of service, we don't know for sure that the notice was actually mailed, do we?
We do. Well, in the record is a copy of the actual hearing notice. It's addressed to her uncle's address, the same address where she did, in fact, receive the notice to appear, and the same address where she did, in fact, receive the removal order. That copy of the hearing notice is in the record, and beyond that, no, there isn't any direct evidence in the record. But again, we can presume that such a notice, which is addressed to the correct address, the address that petitioner herself provided when she was released on her own recognizance, as evidenced by the I-830 form, we can, I think, reasonably assume that the hearing notice was sent to that address.
Certainly it would make our jobs easier if certified mail, even though it's not required by statute, if certified mail were utilized, wouldn't that be a better practice?
It would be an alternative.
A better policy. I mean, a better policy. I mean, then you'd have some concrete evidence. I mean, I understand who the burden is on, but it seems to me that I just from a policy standpoint, it would be a better practice.
Right. I mean, I first want to note that I can't speculate as to why Congress wrote the Immigration Nationality Act the way it is. And the Department of Homeland Security is permitted to send such notice by regular mail. That being said, the Supreme Court's decision in Jones v. Flowers noted, I'm not sure if it was in dicta or not, but it explicitly noted one reason why regular mail might be used. And that is, in some instances, regular mail actually ensures or is a better way to effectuate service of a hearing notice because
All the mail that's lost and sort of well documented that the post office loses a lot of mail.
I can't disagree with that comment. I think we've all lost a piece of mail one time or another. But the Supreme Court decision Jones v. Flowers did acknowledge that when certified mail is used, somebody has to sign for that hearing notice when it's delivered. And sometimes no one's there to sign for it, and it sits at the post office. When regular mail is used, in some instances, and not all instances, obviously Congress had their own reasons for writing the statute in the manner that it did, but in some instances, regular mail might actually ensure that the hearing notice is received by its intended recipient.
Just one other question I'm curious about. How did the ICE agent know where her parents lived at 222 Henderson Street?
That is a question that I don't have an answer to. It's not clear from the administrative record. Again, the I-830 form does indicate that she provided her uncle's address, the address where all three of her the documents, the notice to appear, the hearing notice, and the removal order, they are all sent to the same address, and it was an address that's indicated that she provided. I don't have an answer as to how the officers...
Right, because she, February 26th is when they follow her, and she gets off the train, and she goes to the 556 address, and just a few days later, they come to the home of the parents.
That's apparently correct.
Right. Oh, that is the record, isn't it?
Right.
And that's when he tells her, he asks her about how she got in the U.S. and told her that she would receive another notice concerning the hearing date.
That's correct. That's in the record. I would like to acknowledge, though, that petitioner, at any time she received the advisals and warnings about keeping her address certain, at any time, she could have changed her address if her parents' address was the one in which she wished to receive her mail. She told someone at some point that her uncle's address was an address where she could be contacted, and she was contacted there. She received the removal order as well as the notice to appear. So she could have changed her address. She received the notice to appear and received those advisals and warnings about keeping her address current. And also, when she received the I-830 form, it indicates that when she was released on her own recognizance, that she did, in fact, receive those same warnings. I would just like to make one other note about the voluntary departure claim that petitioner raises. Again, for the first time in her opening brief, she did not raise this claim to the board in the first instance. She has not exhausted the claim involving her eligibility for voluntary departure. And this court is well within its bounds to dismiss this claim within the petition for review on that basis alone. Petitioner, also, this court does not have the jurisdiction to review the denial of voluntary departure relief, nor does it have the authority in the first instance to grant voluntary departure relief. And as the case stands right now, petitioner is not eligible for voluntary departure. She's not eligible for post-order voluntary departure because she's not met the one-year physical presence requirement, as the administrative record illustrates. And she's also not eligible, as the case stands right now, for pre-order voluntary departure because, as petitioner's counsel acknowledges, she had to file for such relief at or prior to the master calendar hearing. And obviously, petitioner did not show up for the master calendar hearing. So at this time, she's not statutorily eligible for either of those forms of relief. If the panel does not have any further questions, I'd just like to conclude by again stating that the petition for review should be dismissed because petitioner failed to exhaust the current claim she raises in her opening brief for the first time. And alternatively, the petition for review should be denied. because the Board of Immigration Appeals and the immigration judge did not abuse their discretion when they held the petitioner had not met her burden of proof and she has not demonstrated non-receipt of the hearing notice. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Tom Alvarado? You've got several minutes. If you wrap it up.
On the first point, Your Honor, Mr. Cisneros did present the assertion I earlier mentioned before the Board of Immigration Appeals and before the immigration. They're in her affidavit and in the body of the brief before the issue of Officer Trevino visiting her at her home, the issue of the conversation that took place between the two of them. The fact that she filed the motion to reopen is only something that the board itself would have been able to glean from the record itself. The other point is that this court doesn't need to decide whether Ms. Cisneros' factual allegations are sufficient to prove non-receipt of the hearing notice. As other courts have done, they've decided whether or not the evidence is sufficient to warrant reopening and an evidentiary hearing. Obviously, at an evidentiary hearing before an immigration judge, Officer Trevino could be subpoenaed to testify whether or not he appeared at Mrs. Narrow's home, whether or not, or who gave him the address that he initially went to, which was the uncle's address, also in Joliet. That is what can at least give Mrs. Narrows an opportunity to prove that she did not receive notice of the hearing and that was the reason for her not attending. The voluntary departure issue, once again, we're not asking Your Honors to grant her voluntary departure. We're simply trying to show that she had a motivation for going to this hearing because she would have been eligible. There is pre-hearing voluntary departure that's applied for before a person is issued a notice to appear. There's voluntary departure that one can apply for at the end of removal proceedings, which usually happens at an individual calendar hearing, which Ms. Marisol Cisneros would not have been eligible for because, as the government counsel contends, she had not been in the United States for a year prior to the time she was served with a notice to appear. But she most definitely would have been eligible to apply for voluntary departure at the master calendar hearing. And that's where the judge might have given her at maximum 120 days to depart the United States voluntarily.
Okay, thanks. And thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement. That completes the arguments for today. And, of course, we'll be in recess until next week.